From the Land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 15th day of December, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Chip Nellinger. He's at Blue Reef Agri-Marketing out of Morton, Illinois. Wayne Nelson is out of the office today. A bit later in the program, we'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast with Don Day at Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And as we close out our time together, we'll take up the agricultural energies with Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, Illinois. Along the way, we'll hear part one of a two-part interview. Tomorrow, we'll hear more about the impact of commodities, but we'll talk with North Dakota State University Extension agricultural economist Frayne Olson about phase one of the China trade agreement and what he thinks that means this year and next. And this year, meaning the calendar year, will end shortly. We'll do all of that right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn today finished at $4.24¾, up 0.75¢. The May a half higher at $4.27¼. And December corn at $4.12¼, up a half. January beans, $11.84¼, 14¾ higher. The March contract up 14¼ at $11.88¾. And November soybeans at $10.65, up 6¢ for the day. Soybean meal at $3.88.20, up $7.50. And the bean oil at $39.19, 46¢ higher. A wheat futures soft red up 3¼ at $5.99¾. In the lead March, the hard red March at $5.66. That finished 3¾ higher. Live cattle futures finished the nearby at $108.60, 50¢ lower for the December. Feeder cattle at $140.10, up 7½¢ for the day. And lean hogs in the February at $66.45 for 100 pounds. They finished 77½¢ higher. Chip Nellinger at Blue Reef Agri-Marketing now joins us to discuss the marketplace. Hey, thanks, Chip, for being with us. Soybeans finished the day really well. Why'd they rally?
Yeah, that's an understatement. Double digits higher, right up near the highs of the day. I think first and foremost, we had the crush report out. They're expecting 180 million bushel crush. It came in a million bushels above that at 181. I believe that's the fourth largest crush for this point on the calendar ever. And so it just goes to show that even at these levels, we are still, have a big demand base, and it doesn't look like we're rationing. And, that really was reflected today. Kind of light volume, starting into that holiday mode type feel, maybe a little bit early this year, right ahead of the holidays. But beans certainly had a good day. I think the crush was part of it. Obviously, there's still a lot of dry weather in some growing areas of South America as well that's fueling some of the buying as well.
But it probably is really good news that there is a secondary bullish sentiment that continues in the soybean market, because weather alone, if it doesn't stick around, could not sustain this rally, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it helped underscore the demand side. The weather side, there have been some rains in areas in South America, both Brazil and Argentina. And there's some areas that are really good right now and in really good condition. It hasn't been general as they like down there, but it hasn't been the constant, bullish news. You got to feed the bull every day. And we haven't been doing that based on some rain in the forecast and some actual precip down in the Southern Hemisphere. So it was good to kind of refocus the market today on the demand side, which, even here just shy of $12, doesn't look like we're rationing a whole lot yet.
Corn wasn't able to muster much in the way of an upside potential for the day, given the amount of those double-digit gains in the soybeans.
It wasn't. Corn still stuck in about a 7-8 day, maybe 10-day trading range here, just going sideways. I think some of the recent volatility in wheat has led to some short wheat, long corn spread unwinding. I think you're still maybe seeing some of that. And corn just seems content to sit here and grind a little sideways. I think underlying, speaking on the demand side of the equation, there's starting to be a little bit of concern I'm picking up about some slowing ethanol, margins and production. We're kind of backing up the, stocks a little bit of ethanol based on some of these varying degrees of state shutdowns because of COVID. And so there's a little bit of concern there, I think. On the demand side, we haven't seen any big Chinese sales confirmed here recently. And so corn seems to be just stuck in a range here, right around that 4.25 level, give or take a few cents on either side, and maybe just content to grind sideways here into the end of the year until we know a little more about South America.
You mentioned that we had not a bad day in Chicago. Is that still just related to the available exportable wheat that'll be on the marketplace?
It is. You know, we had a big buy the rumor, sell the fact type of trade. We finally got some confirmation, long-awaited confirmation of what Russia is going to do. It appears they're going to put a $30 a ton export tax in place starting in February. The problem is between now and February, those exporters in that Black Sea area of Russia are going to push to get every bushel they can out into the export market before that export tax takes effect. So there's going to, for the short period of time, going to flood the market a little bit, but longer term, that's a friendly situation. Still very dry over there. It's been very cold, potential winter kill problems. Obviously, we have our dry weather concerns in the plains, and we're going to need to make sure we get some more moisture going into spring and exit dormancy in the plains, or we could be maybe looking at some reduced production potential out of Oklahoma and Kansas.
Anything from the livestock side before I let you go?
Very quiet there. You know, cattle seem also like holiday mode, content to slop sideways a little bit here. I think that the good news is they've gotten through a lot of volatility in the box beef without doing much damage to the futures. Cattle on feed Friday, and the hog market seems content to kind of slop a little bit here, but very quiet on the livestock side so far this week.
Hey, thanks so much, Chip.
You bet. Thank you.
Chip Nellinger is with Blue Reef Agri-Marketing. Earlier in the week, I called North Dakota State University to talk to Frayne Olson, who's their Extension Agricultural Economist, about the commodity markets. We'll take up his discussion about the commodity markets tomorrow during the closing market report, but today we'll take up the Phase 1 trade agreement with China. He has some thoughts about it.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks. First, appreciate the opportunity to visit. And you're absolutely right. Because the soybeans that are grown in this part of the U.S. Almost exclusively go into the Chinese market, the Asian market in general, but China specifically, you know, our local prices are very, very sensitive to this. So I get a lot of questions about, what is the Phase 1 agreement? Where are we at? What does it look like? What are the impacts? And so first we have to do a super brief recap. So in the Phase 1 trade agreement, there's actually two chapters. Out of the six chapters in the total agreement, two of them have an impact on agriculture. One of them is specifically targeting agricultural products, and the other one is what they call expanding trade, which is really the Chinese promise to purchase additional agricultural products. And those two are actually interconnected and linked. And the grain markets today, both corn, soybeans, and to some degree wheat, have been impacted both directly and indirectly from those provisions. So very quickly, the Chapter 6 on expanding trade, where China promised to buy more U.S. ag products, is the one that's gotten the most public attention. That's the one that I get a lot of questions on. How are we doing? Are we on track? Are they ahead or behind? But the Chapter 3 actually has equally important, because those Chapter 3 allowed it is negotiated where it allows the U.S. agricultural products to enter China more easily. It's all of these non-tariff trade barriers. It's this sanitary, phytosanitary regulations. It was the GM regulations. So, for example, up until recently, you know, the U.S. exporter still had to certify that there was no MIR 162 traits in corn leaving the United States and entering China, because China had not approved the MIR 162 trait. Well, this phase, Chapter 3 of Phase 1, allowed that U.S. corn to enter. And look what's happened. Yes, there's a strong underlying demand for feed products in China, but that removing that hurdle, removing that limitation, allowed a lot more corn to flow into the Chinese market. Okay, so let's go to Chapter 6, which is the one about reaching the targets. And there's still some debate about you know, what is the actual target? So the agreement said China in calendar year 2020 would purchase an additional $12.5 billion of U.S. ag products over a 2017 number. We don't know the exact 2017 number. It's kind of being debated, but it's between 20 and 24 billion dollars. So it's, you know, pretty large number, but they agreed to purchase an additional 12.5. Well, 19.5, an additional $19.5 billion is a target for 2021, which is, again, a very large number. So the question, will they reach the 2020 numbers? Probably not. It will likely be the total dollar volume purchased will likely be above what we saw in 2017, but I don't think the increase will be large enough to reach the target. So now another question, what happens? Are we going to see the shortfall from 2020 be rolled into the 2021 number and increasing the 2021 number? Or is this simply going to be, well, we didn't quite make it, so we're just going to shift into the 2021 number. You know, these are all really important targets. China does have the underlying feed demand as well as demand for animal protein. So we are exporting quite a bit of pork as well as some poultry into the Chinese market now, which we have not done in a long, long, long time. So we're at this linkage between the Chinese market and the U.S. agricultural market now has become a lot stronger. It's become a much greater influence than it was before, but which is a good thing because we're now seeing higher agricultural prices, but also means that this risk of additional trade issues as we move forward in time may actually have more widespread effect on U.S. agriculture.
What are the stumbling blocks that you've been considering on that point?
Well, there's a few of them. And again, these are all open for debate and kind of observation, but the ones that have historically been listed, traditionally been listed the last couple of years have been obviously intellectual property rights. It's been access to banking and finance. It's been business investment where not only U.S. companies operating in China, what they can do, but also Chinese companies operating in the United States. A few new ones that have not kind of been added, and I think that given the change in administration now, the Biden administration will have some additional things that they're going to add to the list that potentially could cause issues. One of them, of course, is the oversight of Hong Kong, and that's been in, you know, politically in the news for a while. There's some concerns about Taiwan and the independence of Taiwan. China, the mainland China, has been from a military standpoint, kind of teasing the Taiwanese and with some flyovers of their jets and some military sea operations in the Sea of China. So Taiwan is a very close political ally with the United States. You know, how far will the mainland China push the Taiwan independence? There's been some issues about COVID-19, about, you know, the source of COVID-19 and the response that China had with releasing information. There's quite a difference in environmental standards now between what we see in the United States and what we see in China. There's a lot of labor issues that I know are really important for trade deals, making sure that we have equitable trade so that the labor requirements in the United States are very similar to the ones that we have in our trading partners. There's also human rights issues. There's been some issues, some concerns about importing Chinese products from certain parts of China into the United States because the claim is that there's human rights abuses going on in those provinces. So, you know, this, again, double-edged sword with trade with China. On one side, there's the demand and the demand base, and the United States is well-positioned to be able to supply not only feed products, but also animal protein into the Chinese market, which is, you know, obviously helping our U.S. prices. But if our linkage becomes tighter, China becomes a larger customer of U.S. agriculture. That also means that if there are political tensions or if there's additional things come on the line or cause problems between U.S. and China, What does that do to the agricultural markets if there's these issues that do come up? If additional disputes become a major trade blockage, you know, when China put a tariff on U.S. soybeans, we took about $2 out of the soybean market. You know, could the same thing happen if we have another dispute? I'm not saying it will. I'm not saying that it's going to be a major shift in politics. But it is one of those risks that we have to think about as we move forward in time.
That's North Dakota State University Extension agricultural economist Frayn Olson. I spoke with him earlier in the week. We'll take up with him the answer to that last question. What's the impact in 2021 of the Phase One trade agreement with China? Be sure to join us tomorrow. Don Day now joins us from Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's cool here today, Don. Actually colder than it has been for a while. How about in your part of the world?
Yeah, pretty chilly. You know, no one's breaking any cold records, but it's certainly been a transition to a colder, more typical December pattern here over the last week or so after what has been a fairly mild start to winter. But that's all changing as we look ahead.
Well, I'll come back to that. I do want to catch up on that big storm that's making its way into the eastern part of the United States. It's called to be a big one, at least for the month of December. What can you tell me about it?
Well, it's going to certainly be the largest winter storm of the season so far. If you've taken a look at all the storms we've seen in terms of its impacts, it's not much of a system right now. We've got a little bit of light snow across portions of Oklahoma, Kansas, and eastern Colorado and Nebraska area, bringing some of those winter wheat areas some needed moisture. It's just not much of a system, but what'll happen over the course of the next 24 to 48 hours is that it's going to slide out of the Plain States and then head up along the eastern slopes of the Appalachians and form an area of low pressure just off the coast of Delaware, New Jersey, and blow up into a very strong winter storm. And we're looking at snowfall amounts that could be 1 to 2 feet across some of the higher terrain of Pennsylvania, parts of New York State, and it looks like New York City, Philadelphia, all will see significant snow.
And then let's come back to that tease that you gave us up front. Are things changing, and what do you expect going into the month of January and the end of December?
As we ring in the new year, we could end up with some really interesting weather across all of North America, and I'm going to throw Canada in there as well. We're seeing some signs of some big cold air masses building over the globe into Siberia, up around the Hudson Bay area, the Northwest Territories of Canada. Right now, that cold air is being stopped from penetrating too far south. But as we leave December, as we get to the end of the month and into the first few days of January, we're seeing the potential. You hear this sometimes during the course of the winter season, the polar vortex. Well, indications are that it may pop south and then lead to a much colder weather pattern regime for a lot of the United States as we head into the new year.
Do you have, it'll depend on how far south it drops, but do you have an idea of what that's going to be like and where there's a division line, if any?
Well, I would certainly say as you get into the northern plain states, you talk about the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, parts of the Great Lakes and the western Corn Belt. Those are the areas that I think could really see, at least initially, the real cold weather. You know, one thing we have not had this winter yet is any prolonged period or any sustained below zero temperatures or single digit temperatures. We've had cold episodes, but not prolonged ones. But as we get to that time frame of just after Christmas into that New Year's week, those are the areas, the northern plain states, that I'd watch out for.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Don Day. He's with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Let's turn our attention now to the agricultural energies. Dave Chatterton is here from Strategic Farm Marketing. Thank you, Dave, for being with us. I take it there's some news from the OPEC front. Let's start with that, please.
Yeah, Todd, OPEC has been meeting here recently. If we take you back just a little bit, OPEC had made some emergency cuts related to COVID. They were taking 7.7 million barrels per day of oil, of crude oil, off the world market here over the last several months. And that agreement was due to expire here in January. They initially indicated that they would raise their production by 2 million barrels per month and start making up for that. And then they kind of went full circle and said, we're not going to raise at all. And then they finally made an agreement where they're going to raise, but only by 500,000 barrels per day, starting in January, and reviewed there monthly thereafter. So that's a piece of the puzzle here that's allowed energy to rally. If you kind of go back and look at where, let's say, crude oil and refined fuels were, we really bottomed out, you know, prices early in November, and it's been in a strong uptrend since. We've seen funds have been net buyers in each of the last 5 weeks here, and the bet here is that it's kind of a battle between optimism on the vaccine rollout here and what that will do to fuel demand in 2021 versus these kind of tighter lockdowns that we've seen implemented here in just the last couple of weeks, Todd.
Have you been thinking very much about ethanol usage and COVID's impact going into the month of January?
Yeah, I mean, it continues to be a struggle here if we look forward here. Ethanol prices during that same period that we just talked about for crude oil actually were down as opposed to up for, you know, crude gasoline and distillate fuel. Ethanol prices were lower, and they were lower by about, let's say, 18 to 20 cents over the last month here. And plant and processor, you know, margins here have been tough. We're looking at margins that are that peaked in that late October time period and near break even, and have since slipped below that. And there are some plants, because of, you know, stronger DDG prices, capturing corn oil, CO2, and those things, that are getting by and making a little bit of money here. But in general, it remains kind of a tough deal. If you look at where gasoline demand is, just let's say last week on the EIA data, we're at about 9.1 million barrels. You know, a year ago at this time, last week, we were 7.6. You know, per day, that's a 16% drop. And of course, that translates directly over to ethanol, where we see production down almost 8% year over year. So it's going to be a struggle here. We've got a new administration coming into Washington. There haven't been any big indications that we're making changes, but certainly I think the value of the RINs here indicates that we probably think that Biden will do away with some of these small refinery exemptions. If you go back and do, you know, look at that, we had, you know, roughly 8 or 10 under the Obama administration. That jumped to 75 to 80 during the Trump administration. And I think the industry is hopeful that that's going to roll itself back here and allow these RIN values to maybe readjust. So we've got a lot of politics going on in the first quarter, but fuel demand is really where it's going to be at, Todd.
And what are your expectations for fuel demand?
Well, I think we've seen just in the last couple of days here, both OPEC and the IEA go out and revise their demand estimates a little bit lower. So we're talking about 500,000 barrels per day, 400,000 barrels per day, lower than their initial assessments. And I still think it's going to be an uphill climb the first half of 2021. And then by the back half of the year, hopefully we can get back to where we were. You know, we need to see a rebound in gasoline demand if we're going to pull that ethanol forward and do the things that we would like to see happen in our marketplace. I should say and mention, while we're on ethanol, even though we're looking at corn usage year over year here, that's down about 62 million bushels year over year. That's about 4.5%. But we are on target to hit the USDA number for this crop year, which will last through, you know, late next summer through August of next year. Beyond that, you know, we're looking for things to get better, Todd, but I think it's going to be a slow healing process here.
Hey, Dave, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Dave Chatterton is with Strategic Farm Marketing from Champaign, Illinois. Joined us on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.